Yeah, right. So I'm Rick Hansen. It's December 9th, 2015. And I want to pick up on the sort of suggestion, instruction I offered for the meditation. Be still and know the sweet joy of the way. That's what the Buddha said, or at least what we think he said, right? So be still and know the sweet joy of the way. And relating to that statement, as an actual instruction, not merely a Hallmark card sentiment, but truly, be still and know the sweet joy of the way. And I've been really touched by the implications of that. And it's a saying that comes back to me again and again. For one, because it's short and I can remember it. Be still and know the sweet joy of the way. And it has two parts to it, obviously. The first part is to be still. And there are different examples of that or metaphors for that. A classic metaphor is that the mind is like a pond that's constantly being disturbed. And we spend our lives looking for jewels. And yet when the pond quiets and the sediments gradually settle, we then see all the jewels that have always already been there. Or I thought to myself, I should have brought a prop. Someone gave me a snow globe with, of course, a Buddha inside. So I'd like you to be with me if you can visualize this. So I'm holding my snow globe with a Buddha inside, and I'm shaking it like the mind is normally agitated, right? We're caught up in various things. We're preoccupied with all kinds of stuff. We're rattled by various events. Can't get a parking place at the mall. You know, they said that to me. I really want to have that thing. Go to the Golden State Warriors, 23-0, you know, whatever it might be. You can't see the Buddha inside the snow globe, right? But when it gradually stills, calms down, slows down, and quiets, then you see what was always already there. Many metaphors like that. So we come here in part, as I said at the very beginning, to find a sanctuary, a place, as he put it, of seclusion, where we disengage from the busyness externally, and we create an opportunity for the busyness internally to settle down, like the snow globe settling down, and we allow a quieting to occur. The body starts relaxing, the mind gradually disengages from its preoccupations, its loops, we slow down, and there's a kind of stilling. And in the process of that, we feel better. We kind of, we refuel ourselves. We, you know, feel less frazzled and, you know, discombobulated and entangled with things. And also, as we get stiller, we're able to see more the nature of our own mind. And as we also get stiller, the engines of craving and chasing and grasping kind of increasingly calm down. There's a lot of emphasis in the great traditions of the world on tranquility, stillness, and with that stillness, a steadiness of mind, a concentrated, quiet mind. There's some basic summary instructions from the Buddha around meditation that describe a roadmap. He basically says, you know, of a deep practitioner, the mind is steadied internally. That's number one. Quieted, brought to singleness, a kind of unification, and then concentrated in a deep, deep, non-ordinary state of awareness in terms of deep contemplative absorption. Think of that as a roadmap. The first two, if not even three steps, are very accessible to us in regular home practice. Steadied internally, quieted, gradually tranquilized, not numb, not suppressed, quieted, and then brought to singleness. And if possible, maybe there's a flash of it, concentrated. And maybe sometimes even more than a flash. So you can see the emphasis there. You can see it in various other traditions, people going off into places of seclusion to just really quiet and become still. Or people going silent for a while, disengaging from language to become still. In Buddhism, the seven factors of awakening include tranquility, which of course is a lot of stillness, as well as concentration itself and equanimity, three out of seven, right off the top, have to do with a certain stability, a certain quieting, a certain steadying. So there's a place for stillness. So I invite you to consider in very practical terms where, you know, how you come to stillness yourself. And I want to, you know, name a couple that seem pretty accessible. One is to just stop. Like, how often, even for 10 seconds or a breath or a minute, do we just stop? Instead of rushing about, just sitting quietly, or the meal is placed before us. Do we dive in, or do we just stop for a second to recognize the elements in that meal and all the causes that came together to make that meal? The people driving the trucks that carried the lettuce to, you know, the Safeway that ended up on our plate. And everything else, you know, the rays of sun that were congealed there in green growing things that we're now eating or feed the animals, let's say, whose bodies we eventually perhaps eat. So can we come to stillness there? I found myself reflecting on, I was actually looking at you, to just go still for a moment to actually receive the other person. We're so busy transmitting so much of the time. You know, we're caught up in our thoughts. What are we going to say next? Our own relationship with the person, our own observing of how we want to be, right? And to just disengage for a moment, to stop that, to actually be quiet enough in the moment to receive that other person, to kind of blink and get that other person. That's a kind of stilling. Also, sometimes another form of stilling is to kind of step out of or back from wrangles with others, disentangling, even mild ones, like, I can't believe you cut in front of me in that line, right? Or Verizon, I got a new phone today, yay! And so Verizon wants me to, you know, spend $15 activation fee. I didn't know about that. Well, okay, $15, but it's just $15. You know, but to pull back from that, and obviously other examples. I got into a stupid argument with my wife last night. And you know, the best arguments are the stupid ones, because they're the ones you can really learn the most from. I'll spare you the gory details. Should we turn on the electrical heater or not? We have solar energy now, finally, but on the other hand, it's not very efficient. Blah. Okay, whatever. You know, I won't tell you which side of the argument I was on. It was the wrong side. Anyway, it was the losing side. I hate to lose. So at some point, you pull out from that, right? You just get still. Like, let the body go still. What do we do? We, you know, kind of let the body be still. Okay, stillness. Okay, right? So you might ask yourself, what are ways you could have a little more emptiness, a little more stillness, a little more stopping, a little more quieting in your own real life? Okay? And that's not enough. It's not enough to just go tranquil, to just go quiet. We must also know the sweet joy of the way. So there's a lot in that. Know the sweet joy of the way. For one, there's this emphasis on knowing that joy. In other words, experiencing. I've been talking the last few weeks about how Buddhism is a fundamentally experiential practice. It's experiential, and I think it's very easy to get way caught up in the more theoretical, analytical, conceptual, you know, cool Dharma aspects, and maybe even caught up in some of the morality, restraint parts, don't steal, don't kill, whatever, virtue aspects, kind of top-down self-regulation. But what about the juicy, luscious, upward rising, you know, inside out, bottom up, enjoyments? You know, the lusciousness of being dropped into our experience enough to really know it rather than theorize about it from the outside, looking at it, but inside out, knowing of our experience, even so deeply we start recognizing its nature, thereby becoming increasingly free in our relationship with it. And also having experiences that are joyful and sweet and inspired, right? Knowing the sweet joy of the way. So there's the knowing of the joy of your own practice, concretely. And so there is this way. What does the way look like in everyday life? Well, think about small ways you're practicing, or the way that you are practicing, and that which you are giving yourself over to. So you might think to yourself, wow, you know, I decided to not pound on that point with that other person about the electrical heater, right? That's a moment of practice. Or I decided that, you know, in terms of my own practice around food, that I'm going to stop with one cookie. That's my practice. Or I'm going to let that other person have the last cookie, even though, oh my God, those chocolate chips, I so want them, right? What's that? Or maybe the joy of meditation, the mind calming, or the way of non-clinging, right? The sweet joy, knowing the joy in non-clinging, not just taking it on as like this driven, dry discipline, but feeling the joy of it while doing it. Wow, right? So I really invite you to kind of reflect on the way, as it were, you've maybe given yourself over to today. And some of the little sweet joys that are maybe retrospectively available in it, or even the sweet joy in coming together to engage the Dharma or to engage some investigation into suffering and lasting happiness. Wow, that's a joy. You know, I am right now feeling kind of the joy of gratitude. Gratitude, such a fundamental practice. You know, the gratitude for this building, generously given to us, loaned to us, as it were, by the Dominican University here, the people who use this as a temple, as a chapel, an interfaith gathering place. Wow. That's a joy, right? A moment of insight. If you're practicing a little bit of insight, recognizing impermanence or transience or what feels contracted and pressured and thus craving-based versus what feels lighter, looser, less contracted, more released, you know. That's practice, knowing the joy of your own practice. Right? Be still and know the sweet joy of the way. What do you think about really inviting yourself into that and realizing, wow, as I know the sweet joy of this way, I become more motivated, less of a jerk, and also somehow I get enlivened by and illuminated by this joy and the way that carries that joy along. Yeah? Right? So then the question becomes also, what is the way? And the way is a path, it's a process, it's progressive, so it has that quality to it that's very much, you know, commented on, again, in the world's traditions, even if that path is a gradual revelation of what was always already true, like the Buddha inside the snow globe in your heart that was always already there, there's still something progressive about the gradual revealing of that truth. Okay? So there's a progressive process. That's hopeful. You don't need to have it all together at all times. There's a progressive process. Okay? Also, the way is often described as a stream. And you may know that in especially kind of roots Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, grounded in our best record of what the Buddha taught, there were four stages of awakening. The first of the four being stream entry, entering into the stream, being carried by the stream. In this way of considering the way, there's a giving over to good. So you might ask yourself, what is your stream? What is the way you are trying to help yourself become increasingly given over to? Especially the next sort of step, you know, the next deeper current. What do you follow that? It's one way to think of practice or personal growth or awakening as this muscular scratching and clawing up the slopes of Mount Doom, you know. I can relate to that very much myself, you know. I ain't going to quit, you know. Too legit to quit. What was it? That's a rap lyric. I forget it. Who said that? Just going to kind of hammer. There we go. Anyway, too legit to quit. No. Another way to think of it, though, is that you're given over to something that's sweeping you along. I don't know, like scratch, claw, you know, or give over to. Pretty powerful to give over to. So you might ask yourself, what are you giving yourself over to that you can already experience the sweet joy of? Wholesomeness, virtue of different kinds. Almost they're the background commitments that you have that you hardly even give yourself credit for because you're already so given over to them. But if you knew them more freshly, you could experience the sweet joy in giving over to them. Or others that maybe are just the next step. And like the sweet joy in giving yourself over to a deeper level of sobriety, broadly defined. Not just the obvious sobrieties about substances, but the deeper sobrieties around negative preoccupations or resentments against others or fascinations of various kinds, you know, political addictions. You know, what did Donald Trump say today? And round and round we go. Well, I joke with my wife sometimes. We go on these websites. It's like progressive porn or something. It says, you know, what are we caught up in? Whatever it might be, whatever that is, right? Could you give yourself over to that? Or perhaps give yourself over to, you know, taking things one step less personally with the in-laws, the relatives, or other people. Or, you know, give yourself over one more step to love, to kindness toward others. So, right, what's your way? And what would it feel like to describe practice as a kind of giving over to that involves an appreciation of, an enjoyment of the joy, right, in whatever you're giving yourself over to? Giving yourself over to good company, you know, giving yourself over to actually taking those few extra seconds to really be present with other people, you know, that you're looking at or speaking with. Okay, so far. And then one, so then I have a couple of practical, I have three practical suggestions. And we'll see what you think. Right? Be still and know the sweet joy of the way. So I've been doing this little practice in my mind that relates to some of the things I've talked about the last few weeks related to those little mini movies that are running in the simulator. And if, you know, you probably can recognize, it's very normal, that we're just kind of hanging out, and what will come to mind is this little, we get drawn into a little daydream or a little preoccupation. And sometimes it's negatively focused around some sort of threat, okay? For example, like what could go wrong? So we're preoccupied with what could go wrong. And then we start formulating our solution to that problem. It's like we have a mind searching for a problem, searching for something wrong or off or something to fix. My mom, for example, when she was alive, she really wanted to help other people. And the way she would help them is by helping them appreciate what they needed to improve. She was well-intended, but to be on the receiving end of that, to be an improvement project, and you get to see her, like, literally. I'd say, hey, Mom, look at my new shirt, you know, and literally. And I just watch her eyes scanning for the loose thread and this look of discontent on her face until she found it. And then she was happy because she knew what was wrong and what could be improved, right, and she could help you with. See, you follow that process? And there's a way a lot of us are that way ourselves with the larger world that we're in, you know, searching for the problem or searching for the threat. Maybe there's an anxious preoccupation. Or maybe in that mini movie, there's something that's more pleasure seeking. Like, oh, you know, what TV show will I watch tonight? Or something, right? Or, you know, can I afford to let myself have that sweet? You know, preoccupation with that brownie that I know is waiting for me. And I know I should only have this much, but I want that much, and right? Or think about an interpersonal preoccupation. You know, when I see them the next time, I'm going to be sure to make that point, okay? Or, right? Okay? Or in that email, or okay, good. So it has that character. So you think of the structural nature of that little mini movie, right? We're kind of lost in it. And there's this seemingly solid threat or reward or other person. And there's a quality of craving in it, right? A kind of a drivenness of some kind. Eliminate the threat, get that reward, or make that thing happen with that other person. And, you know, that's human, that's natural. It was actually a phenomenal evolutionary development to be able to have the simulator, to imagine possible futures and, you know, different scenarios and evaluate them and kind of mentally rehearse how we'll operate in certain situations. On the other hand, there's a lot of trouble in there because often it's problematic, right? We're overly preoccupied with some threat, we're overly anxious, we're obsessed about it, or we're kind of addictively driven towards some problematic reward, or we're preoccupied with our relationships in some way. So what's an alternative? You could give over to an alternative good. And I've really started to do this because so much of what that's about is about the future. If I do this, I'll prevent the threat, right? If I do that, I'll get the cookie. Or if I do this thing, it'll make it better in the relationship, right? And that's very future-oriented. It's very predictive. That's what the simulator is designed to do. It's very biologically based, if you think about it. It's very good for survival in the wild. But it creates a lot of discontent. And it reinforces neurons that fire together, wire together. It reinforces a lot of problematic operating. What's the alternative? The alternative is really interesting. Imagine to yourself, what would be the good alternative way to be? If you're worried about something, you know, something feels threatening to you. I don't mean ignoring real threats, but I mean, and also, what would help you feel better about that threat if it were more present in your mind? For example, a sense of other people being there for you, or a sense of perspective about the threat is a very rare and unlikely event. My long-suffering wife is preoccupied with our house getting flooded. Now, there's some basis in reality about that because we're at the bottom of a hill. The hill kind of drains into a culvert in our backyard. The culvert routinely gets blocked. When it's blocked, water flows into the house. She's preoccupied with that. But on the other hand, alongside that fear could be the recognition that first, you know, we're fixing things in our yard so that it doesn't happen. Second, it's never happened, right? Right. Third, it's a very rare event if it really were to be problematic, like some superstorm, right? And fourth, even if our house got flooded, it would be bad, but our kids would still be alive. We'd be okay. We'd still love each other. It's all right. And we have homeowners insurance. Now, these are like middle-class preoccupations, but my point is I'm just kind of working it through. But when she's in the simulator, that's just not present at all. Or if I'm like in my own simulator and I'm thinking, oh yeah, what fun thing are we going to do tonight, right? Because I'm more, you know, pleasure-seeking. She's more fear-averting. You know, I could have that alongside that, a fundamental sense of contentment already. You know, or a fundamental sense perhaps of the Buddha alongside me saying, Rick, come on. You know, that's like as far as Coach Buddha needs to go. It's like, you know, I get it. Like, oh yeah, what am I doing driven toward that thing? If it happens, it happens. It's sweet, but why the drivenness? You see what I'm saying? So one thing you could do from a very practical standpoint is when you find yourself caught in the simulator, drawn into some problematic thing, imagine the positive alternative to have in your mind and try to give yourself over to that. And technically, well, that will tend to do, especially if that positive alternative is big and prominent, it'll tend to soothe and eventually replace that negative fix. It's a very powerful method. Is it clear what I'm describing as a technique? It's a kind of narrow, specific technique, but it's very powerful. And it really addresses a lot of self-conditioning, self-reinforcing of the problematic, because we just loop through these sort of mini movies that tend to run many times a day. Okay, got that? You see the idea? So you might ask, no?
Another example.
Let's say that we're preoccupied with a neighbor or coworker who's hurtful or mean, devaluing, problematic, you know, unjust, and it's real. It's true. It's true. Maybe we exaggerated a little bit, but there's a lot of truth to it, okay? It's true. Well, so that's in our mind, and we're preoccupied with it. So you might ask yourself, what's in the mind in there? Maybe there's a sense of helplessness in the mind, being overpowered. Or maybe there's a sense of grievance, or like, I'm going to be really hurt by this, okay? Or maybe we're caught up in a kind of righteousness, a kind of aggrieved righteousness about that. I can relate to every single one of those. So it helps to know a little bit what's there that's problematic, you know, emotionally for us. And then you think, what would be the alternative? So maybe I'm caught up in some righteousness about that person, and I can see that that's a key element in the engine of my suffering. And so I might deliberately go, Rick, you know, more of a sense, the alternative being a kind of a don't know mind or a wider view, right? Or putting it in perspective, yeah, that person is a crummy neighbor, coworker, they said that hurtful thing. When I think about hurtful things being said to me, I can't believe you didn't give my book a 5-star rating, whatever it might be. And I think, give me a break, Rick. Think about what's going on in the world, you know, altogether, or right at home. I mean, as you probably know, my dad died about a month ago, and I spent a fair amount of time for about a week at Kaiser in San Rafael, just wherever that is over there geographically. Right now, as we sit here, just think what's happening there. In the ER, in the ICU, in the general unit, you know, just think. Like, and we're worried about that. You know, so that would be one thing to put it alongside. Or another thing would be and feel supported by another person, right? Because we feel hurt by them, but feeling supported by those who care about us, or a group of people who care about us. Others love me, others care for me, even if they really don't get who I am. Got it? Okay. Second, I want to quote the Dalai Lama. Now, there we go. So, I didn't bring my snow globe. I got to bring my snow globe. I do. Gotta bring my snow globe. This thing hangs on the dresser next to my bed. It's full of clothes, my wife's clothes, that she never wears, but that's all right. Because for her, you know, shopping is like entertainment, you know, but anyway, so. And it has to be on sale. Not just sale, but super duper sale. Okay. You wanna make my wife upset? Buy something at full price. Oh man, it gets her going. Okay, sorry Jan, I know you're listening, honey. Anyway, okay, so I don't know where I went there, but I did. Okay, here we go. So the Dalai Lama, okay? I was reading this paper recently on mindfulness, and I saw, you know, this person who is referenced frequently, Lama D, and I was like, Lama, that's a trippy last name. And I remember, oh, that's the Dalai Lama. That's how they reference that in American Psychologist Journal. Anyway, okay, a precious human life. Precious human life, okay? He says, every day, think as you wake up, today I am fortunate to have woken up. I am alive. I have a precious human life. I am not going to waste it. I am going to use all my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others, to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I am going to have kind thoughts toward others. I am not going to get angry or think badly about others. I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. Plain, simple, direct. Give ourselves over to this. So a second thing I just want to call out is to give ourselves over to love, to give ourselves over to benevolence, to doing what we can, quoting Nkosi Johnson, that South African boy born with HIV, died when he was about 12. He said, to paraphrase, you know, do all that you can with what you've been given in the place where you are in the time that you have. Best we can do, right? So you might again feel your way into that, to give yourself over to love, to benevolence, not being a doormat, not giving up your own rights, all that sort of thing. And also, in your own real life, going home tonight, that next email, that next person, you know, more forgiveness, less resentment, more bigger picture, more compassion, you know, more, what's it feel like to give yourself over to that river of love? And in Buddhism, you know, recent scholarship indicates that the Buddha felt that love, when fully developed, could take you all the way to full enlightenment. Not just kind of dry meditative practices, following the rules the abbot set and the monasteries and all that, but love, fully perfected, leading to complete awakening. Wow. And then the last thing, just in passing, I want to say, also related to the Dalai Lama. You know the two jokes about the Dalai Lama? The first one, of course, is what did he get for his birthday? Got a box, opens it up. Oh, just what I always wanted. Nothing. Right? You know that one. And then there's another one, of course. What did the Dalai Lama say to the hot dog vendor? Make me one with everything. And, right? So you know this. Okay, they're lame, but quite profound. Because in terms of this notion of way, it has this progressive quality. But of course, the way is available, the fruition of the way is always available to us in every moment of complete non-clinging. No need to cling, recognizing that experiences are impermanent. The Buddha is said to have said that anyone who recognizes impermanence, you know, in that moment they are, you know, in the mind of a Buddha, truly recognizes impermanence, particularly of experience. And so in the moment, it's also available to us to know the sweet joy of the way being already fully realized here and now. And I think of the teaching of a Tibetan Lama, Kalu Rinpoche, and this teaching is available at the Gratitude Hut at Spirit Rock, if you go there ever. It's a little hut, it's wonderful room, if you've never been in there. And there's a beautiful picture of him, just so happy, peaceful, loving, smiling, right? And he says this is a close paraphrase. He says, you live in illusion and do not know what is really true. Knowing, understanding, seeing what is really true, you recognize that you are nothing. Recognizing that you are nothing, you are everything. That is all. I love the "that is all" part. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, man. That is all. Right? But it's true. It's like everything, nothing, okay, in the moment. So inviting us all into this moment of everything's enough already. There's really no need to chase anything else. It's all here now. And that, too, is the fruition and the practice of the way with a great joy to it. You know, to the extent you can kind of relax in the now, just in the now, right? And relax, chasing it to be anything else, abiding in its fullness as experience, letting it come, letting it go, and being utterly all right with that. Really, I've been really focused these days, to end on two words, on the two words of undisturbed and undefended as practice. Undisturbed, undefended, right? Now.
And warning, do you warn?
Do I have a warrant?
We need to, right?
What?
Warn a little bit. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Warn well when somebody passes, that's supposed to you.
Oh, I see. Am I supposed to mourn? Well,
no, I'm not saying you're supposed to. I'm saying normally.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
My condolences.
Oh, about my father. Yeah, we'll just finishing up on this, and I'll see what, if maybe we have a couple more minutes, see if there's a question or a comment, then we'll wrap. Because I got to get home to my wife and apologize for being a wanker last night. You know, anyway. So my point is, yeah, stuff flows through us. That's, I think you've made a beautiful point from the bleachers there. You know, stuff flows through us. Mourning over my father, you know, wishing things to be different, body aches, pains, maybe our mood's kind of depressed, maybe we're worried about our children. Who knows what? It's all there. It's all there. But it's really funny, you know, when we just kind of relax about it and we just take it as it is with acceptance and we kind of see the unfoldingness of the mind, even in the midst of great sorrow. I know there's a poet who says something really eloquent here. Even in the midst of great sorrow or pain, there is joy. There can be joy. There can be peace. You know. So finishing on, be still and know the sweet joy of the way. Right? Even with, as you say in the back there, you know, painful, difficult things also present in the mind. So a comment or question, and then we'll just wrap it up. Yeah, great.
As far as the sweet joy of the way, I really like the season a lot. It's one of my favorite seasons, December. I was raised Christian, so, you know, just thinking about Jesus, there aren't as many quotes about Jesus, I think, as Buddha said, but there are a lot in the Bible and so forth.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just so much with it in terms of it being cooler, having the opportunity to wear a flannel shirt. You know, the presence, the giving, the outdoor lights.
Yeah.
I really like the season a lot. Mm-hmm. And boxes of chocolates to come, I'm sure.
That's really good. Yeah. If I were to call out a couple concrete suggestions, it's to make stillness a part of your day. It's really, to protect it. It's like precious, to hold it as precious. Some form of stillness or stopping, any kind. And then a second thing I'd really concretely suggest is look for the enjoyability of your practice. You know, make it experiential. Come down into the body that is enjoying what's enjoyable in your practice, right? And third, have one thing these days that you're particularly opening to, giving yourself over to, you know, letting it carry you along, and know what that is, right? Okay? It might be disentangling from grievance. It might be giving over to a commitment to your practices, accepting the need for exercise or other things. It might be a deliberate giving over to slowing it down to recognize the being behind the eyes or the goodness in the other person, whatever it might be. Have one thing you know that you're particularly giving yourself over to increasingly these days. Okay, last person.
Thinking about in relationships when somebody is acting in a, or you consider inappropriate and insulting you, whatever you mean type of a person is affecting you, when I can, I like to look at that person with compassion, because realizing that if he's that way to me, he's probably that way, if she whatever, to many people, and he's going through life suffering the effects of that kind of behavior.
Yeah.
So from that point of view,
Thank you. Yeah, that's a way you're giving yourself over to. Beautiful. And also, and with that, of course, I would just kind of ask, along with what you said, do you know the sweet joy of that practice of yourself?
Sure.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's know the sweet joy of a minute of reflection, and then we'll finish with three bells. get out of the way of your way. See you next week.
Now, Spirit Rock just published a new